Before signing off, Curl made certain to underscore his greatest anxiety. We want to be absolutely sure this is confidential. At mid-morning on Sunday, David Nason and Kevin Frommer were sitting on the couch in Nason's office at Treasury, going over a draft of the proposal to petition Congress for the authority to inject money into Fannie and Freddie in the case of an emergency. The office was littered with sandwich wrappers and bags from nearby Corner Bakery Cafe. Most of the staff had been working since early Saturday morning, and had gone home only to grab a few hours of sleep. The proposal had to be ready by 7 p.m. Suddenly, Paulson walked into the office with a look of horror on his face, and, holding up a page of the draft, bellowed, "What the fuck is this? Emergency authority on a temporary basis?" "Temporary," he said, almost shouting. "We are not going to ask for temporary authority." The draft provided for emergency authority for a period of 18 months, the rationale for which Frommer, who was Treasury's liaison to lawmakers, leaned forward and attempted to explain. "Look, you can't ask Congress for permanent..." Paulson rarely allowed himself to show his anger, but he now made no attempt to restrain it as he paced the room. "First of all, this is my judgment to make, not yours," he said. "Secondly, this is a half measure. I am not leaving my successor with the same shit that I've got. We are going to fix these problems. I am not pushing this crap down the road." Nason's cell phone rang. "Tim," he shouted, checking the caller ID, before realizing he was interrupting Paulson's soliloquy. Tim Geithner had been calling for updates nearly every hour. Nason and Frommer tried again to calm Paulson down. They reiterated that it would be much more palatable politically to say that they were asking for temporary powers rather than permanent ones. And, as Frommer told him, "it's a distinction without a difference," explaining that during the period they had the authority, they could still make decisions that would be permanent. Paulson, starting to recognize the value of the political calculus, relented. He told them to keep working on it and walked out as abruptly as he'd walked in. Greg Curl, dressed in a blazer and slacks, arrived at Sullivan and Cromwell's Midtown offices in the Seagram building on Sunday afternoon, having flown up to New York from Charlotte that morning on one of the firm's 5 private jets. Taking a seat in the empty reception area, he waited for Fold and Cohen to appear, uncertain about how fruitful the meeting could possibly be. While the boss may have wanted to conquer the commercial banking world, he had an aversion to the fast-money investment banking business. "No, we wouldn't use our petty cash to buy an investment bank," he'd dryly said just a month earlier. Almost a year before, his own investment banking business, long considered and also ran, showed a stunning 93% plunge in profit in its third quarter. At the time, Lewis had remarked that he had had about all the fun he could stand in investment banking right now. Curl was soon escorted to a conference room, where he paid careful attention as Fold walked him through his idea in greater detail. He wanted to sell a stake of up to a third of Lehman Brothers to Bank of America and merge their investment banking operations under the Lehman umbrella. As Curl listened, he was dumbfounded, though characteristically gave no sign of what he was thinking. Far from the plea for help he had been expecting, the pitch he was hearing struck him as a reverse takeover. Bank of America would be paying Fold to run its investment banking franchise for it. Fold also suggested that any investment would boost our stock price overnight, creating even more value for Bank of America. He rationalized that buying a stake in Lehman, as opposed to buying the entire firm, would provide incentive for the firm's savvy bankers to stay in their jobs. "You're not going to be able to keep these people if they can't see a financial upside," he argued, making a relevant point about most full bank mergers, namely, that the talent usually cashes out and leaves. Curl nodded appreciatively throughout the presentation before finally stating that the boss, Lewis, would be interested in entertaining the prospect of a deal only if he had a clear path to taking control of the firm in a reasonable amount of time. Cohen, interjecting on behalf of Fold, suggested that they should think about a time frame of 2 to 3 years, depending on how successful the investment was. That was more along the lines of what Curl wanted to hear. He told them he was intrigued, but that he and Lewis had often disagreed about whether they should acquire an investment bank or continue buying up other commercial banks. "I don't like the retail business," Curl confided, "because of the susceptibility of litigation and attorneys general and regulators." "I'd prefer a deal with you," he continued, "but to be honest, Ken would probably prefer to buy Merrill or Morgan." Fuld was confused. What was Curl signaling? "So, do you think we have something here?" Fuld asked. "I don't know," Curl said. "I need to talk to the boss. It's obviously his decision." By late afternoon, Paulson, unshaven and wearing jeans, was pacing the halls and pestering his staff with so many questions about the Fannie and Freddie proposal that his chief of staff, Jim Wilkinson, finally took him aside and said forcefully, "You've got to get out of our hair and let us do our jobs." To blow off steam, Paulson decided to take a quick bike ride around the near-empty Washington streets. He couldn't stop thinking about the plan and what it might mean to his legacy. He, a Republican, a man of the markets, was going to ask for authority to invest U.S. taxpayer money in the two institutions that were perhaps most responsible for the housing boom and bust. On the other hand, after decades of political infighting over these two entities, he would have the opportunity to undo them. But would he actually need to use the authority that he was asking for? Would simply having the authority be enough to calm the markets? As he pedaled his bike, he hoped that would be the case. When Paulson returned, Michelle Davis, his communications chief, was trying to figure out where he could physically announce the proposal. "We can't have reporters and camera crews in the building," she said. "We could have you go outside on the steps." Nason, walking over to a window, warned that the forecast called for a thunderstorm. "I don't know what to do," she said, trying to figure out if they had a podium they could bring outdoors. "But you have to go home and change clothes," she told Paulson, pointing at his rumpled jeans. "You can't go out there like that." At 6 p.m., cleanly shaven and now dressed in a blue suit, Paulson walked out onto the Treasury's steps to a podium that had been hauled downstairs from the fourth floor and addressed the swarm of reporters who had assembled hastily. "Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac play a central role in our housing finance system and must continue to do so in their current form as shareholder-owned companies," Paulson said, reading a statement. "Their support for the housing market is particularly important as we work through the current housing correction. GSE debt is held by financial institutions around the world. Its continued strength is important to maintaining confidence and stability in our financial system and our financial markets. Therefore, we must take steps to address the current situation as we move to a stronger regulatory structure. To ensure the GSEs have access to sufficient capital to continue to serve their mission, the plan includes temporary authority for Treasury to purchase equity in either of the two GSEs, if needed." Minutes after he finished, thunder rumbled in the distance. Soon, the skies opened up. Paulson could tell the hearing on Tuesday morning was going to be hostile the moment he took his seat to the right of Bernanke and Cox. His announcement on the Treasury steps had done little to shore up confidence. In fact, it seemed to be undermining it even further, creating confusion in the marketplace about what this new authority he was seeking really meant. Freddie ended down 8.3% to $7.11, while Fannie lost 5%, falling to $9.73 on Monday. He knew he needed to start spinning fast, as much for Congress as for the markets. "Our proposal," he explained to the Senate Banking Committee, "was not prompted by any sudden deterioration in conditions at Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. At the same time, recent developments convinced policymakers and GSEs that steps are needed to respond to market concerns and increase confidence by providing assurances of access to liquidity and capital on a temporary basis, if necessary." As he was barraged with questions, Paulson emphasized the temporary nature of the authority he was seeking, hoping to win over the congressman. "It is very intuitive," he said, "that if you've got a squirt gun in your pocket, you may have to take it out. If you have got a bazooka, and people know you've got it, you may not have to take it out. Some panel members, however, were not buying that justification. When I picked up my newspaper yesterday, I thought I woke up in France, said Senator Jim Bunning, the Kentucky Republican. But no, it turned out it was socialism here in the United States of America. The Treasury Secretary is now asking for a blank check to buy as much Fannie and Freddie debt or equity as he wants. The Fed purchase of Bear Stearns' assets was amateur socialism compared to this. Given what the Fed and Treasury did with Bear Stearns, and given what we are talking about here today, I have to wonder what the next government intervention into the private enterprise will be. More importantly, where does it all stop? Clearly frustrated by what he was hearing, Paulson struggled to articulate his defense. I think our idea is that by having the government provide an unspecified backstop, the odds are very low that it will be used, and the cost to the taxpayers will be minimized. Do you think we can believe exactly what you're saying, Secretary Paulson? Bunning replied patronizingly. I believe everything I say, and that I've been around markets for a long time, Paulson began to reply before Bunning cut him off. Where is the money going to come from, if you have to put it up? Bunning asked. Well, obviously it will come from the government, but I would say, who is the government? Bunning asked indignantly. The taxpayer, Paulson acknowledged. Secretary Paulson, I know you're very sincere in your proposal, Bunning continued. But come January, you will be gone, and the rest of us will be sitting at these tables, or at least most of us, and we all have to be responsible to the taxpayer for what we have done. A socialist, Mr. Bailout. Hank Paulson believed he was fighting the good fight, a critical fight to save the economic system, but for his efforts, he was being branded as little less than an enemy of the people, if not an enemy to the American way of life. He couldn't understand why no one could see how bad the situation had really become. That afternoon, another faction had joined the group of antagonists. The hedge funds were furious with him for having convinced Christopher Cox at the SEC to begin cracking down on improper short selling in the shares of Fannie and Freddie, as well as 17 other financial firms, including Lehman. With Bob Steele gone, he felt he had been left on his own to confront the biggest challenge of his tenure. He valued his staff, whom he regarded as a remarkably intelligent group, but questioned whether he had enough firepower to wage what he could see was quickly becoming a heated war. That afternoon, he left a message for Dan Jester, a 43-year-old retired Goldman Sachs banker who had been the firm's deputy CFO and was now living in Austin, Texas, managing money, mostly his own. Paulson had depended heavily on Jester, a long-haired human calculator, when he was the firm's CEO, and he hoped he might be able to convince Jester to come out of retirement to help him work on the GSEs. The night before, feeling somewhat desperate, he had also placed a call from home to Ken Wilson, an old friend from Dartmouth, whom he had persuaded to leave Lazard for Goldman a decade earlier. As head of the Financial Institutions Group, Wilson was Goldman's top advisor to other banks and respected as an eminent Greek throughout the industry. Paulson so respected his judgment that he had put Wilson in an office near his own on the 30th floor of 85 Broad Street. Ken, I really need help around here. I need some adults, Paulson said when he reached him. Bob Steele is gone. I'd like you to think about coming down here and joining my team. Wilson, Paulson proposed, would be a classic dollar-a-year man, meaning that he would come on board as a special advisor for the nominal salary of $1 for the final 6 months of the administration. He suggested that Wilson take a leave from Goldman. Wilson, who at 61 had already been considering retiring from the firm, said that he would think about it. I could use your help, Paulson repeated earnestly. I have lots of issues, lots of problems. Given all the gyrations in Lehman's stock price and the nonstop rumors about its long-term viability, Fuld had scheduled a board meeting in July to update the firm's directors on the progress he had been making on both fronts. Lehman's board was a strange mix of both the financially sophisticated and the truly naive. Most had been old friends of Fuld's or had been clients of the firm. They included Roger S. Berland, a 75-year-old theater producer, and Marcia Johnson Evans, 61, a former Navy Rear Admiral and head of the Red Cross. Until 2 years earlier, the 83-year-old actress and socialite Dina Merrill had also been a member. Among the more experienced were Henry Kaufman, then 81, who was a former chief economist at Salomon Brothers, John Akers, a former chief executive of IBM, and Sir Christopher Gent, 60, former head of Vodafone, PLC. Of the 10 outside directors, 4 were over 74 years old. For this meeting, Fold had invited a guest to give a presentation. Gary Parr, a banker at Lazard, had been speaking with Fold recently and suggested he could try to help the board if the directors needed independent advice. The spindly, bearded Parr was one of the most prominent of the bankers specializing in the financial services industry, having worked on many of the capital-raising efforts that companies like Morgan Stanley and Citigroup pursued in late 2007. Fold may not have trusted Parr's boss, Bruce Wasserstein, but he respected Parr. Parr was asked by one of the directors to offer some perspective on how bad the market really was. An assured speaker, Parr launched into his regular skeptical boardroom speech. "It's tough out there," he said forebodingly. "Having been through Bear Stearns and MBIA, two former clients, there are some lessons we've learned." Trying to make certain that Lehman's directors understood the gravity of the situation they were facing, he told them, "Liquidity can change faster than you can imagine," suggesting they should not think Bear Stearns was a once-in-a-lifetime event. "Rating agencies are dangerous," he went on. "Wherever you think you stand with the rating agencies, it's worse. And let me tell you, it's difficult to raise money in this environment because asset prices are hard for outside investors to under..." "Okay, Gary," Fold said, impatiently cutting him off in mid-sentence. "That's enough." An awkward silence fell over the room for a moment. Some directors thought Fold had become upset with the negative direction Parr had taken. Others believed that he had rightly quieted him for shamelessly plugging his services. Within 10 minutes, Parr slunk out of the room. An hour later, back in his office at Lazard in Rockefeller Center, Parr was informed by his secretary that Dick Fold was on the phone. "God damn it, Gary," Fold screamed when Parr picked up the receiver, half expecting an apology. "What the hell are you doing trying to scare my board and advertising yourself to them like that? I should fire you." For a moment, Parr didn't respond. Frustrated that Lehman hadn't yet signed an engagement letter, Parr snidely fired back, "Dick, that might be difficult because you haven't hired us yet." Then, collecting himself, he said, "I'm sorry. I didn't mean to go down a path you didn't want me to go." "You'll never do that again," Fold said, and the phone went dead. The next day, Fold, perhaps fearing that he was beginning to become unwound, realized that berating Parr had been a mistake. The stress was beginning to get to him. In his mind, he had cut off Parr for running an advertisement for Lazard, not for suggesting the firm was imperiled. But the damage had been done. He called Parr back, hoping to mend the relationship and to invite him for another meeting. "Have you recovered from the phone call?" Fold asked contritely. Ken Wilson was standing in line at Westchester County Airport at 6:45 on the morning of Thursday, July 17th, on his way to fly to Montana to start a vacation and do some fly fishing, when his cell phone rang. "Kenny, we really need you," President Bush told him. "It's time for you to do something for your country." Wilson and the president knew each other from Harvard Business School, but Wilson knew this call had not been the president's idea. This was classic Paulson. He must be really hurting. If Paulson wanted something, he would keep going until he got it, even if it meant enlisting the highest authorities. That weekend, Wilson, after talking it over with his colleagues at Goldman, called Paulson. "I'll do it." On the evening of July 21st, Paulson arrived for a dinner in his honor at the New York Fed, organized by Tim Geithner as an opportunity for the secretary to get together with Wall Street leaders, Jamie Dimon, Lloyd Blankfein, and John Mack among them. The dinner would be the second gathering of Wall Street heavyweights he'd attended that day. He had earlier been to a private luncheon in his honor at the offices of Eric Mendick, a former protege at Goldman Sachs, who now ran a hedge fund called Eaton Park Capital, where he pressed his case for the pending GSE legislation. Paulson was feeling slightly better about the overall situation, as both Wilson and Jester had agreed to join Treasury, and the prospects for the legislation's passing were improving. And, as he mingled among his former colleagues, he congratulated John Thayne of Merrill, who days earlier had sold the firm's stake in Bloomberg for $4.5 billion. What still had Paulson worried, however, was Lehman, and particularly a secret meeting that had been scheduled for after the dinner. He and Geithner had helped orchestrate a private meeting between Dick Fuld and the boss, Ken Lewis, in a conference room at the New York Fed. Fuld had been ringing Paulson for the past 2 weeks about Bank of America, trying to get Paulson to make a call on behalf of Lehman. "I think it's a hard sell, but I think the only way you're going to do it is go to him directly," Paulson had told Fuld. "I'm not going to call Ken Lewis and tell him to buy Lehman Brothers." As the dinner was ending, Paulson walked over to Lewis and said affably, "Those were some good earnings," reaching out to clasp Lewis's hand and giving him a knowing look about the upcoming meeting. Although earlier that day, Bank of America had reported a 41% slide in second-quarter earnings, the results were far better than what Wall Street analysts had expected. That positive surprise followed a series of stronger-than-expected earnings from Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Wells Fargo, all of which were at least temporarily buoying the market. When Paulson turned to leave and other executives started to get up and mill around, Geithner approached Lewis and, leaning close to him, whispered, "I believe you have a meeting with Dick." "Yeah, I do," Lewis replied. Geithner gave him directions to a side room where they could speak in private. Geithner had apparently already given Fuld the same instructions, because Lewis noticed him across the room looking back at them like a nervous date. Seeing Fuld start to walk in one direction, Lewis headed in the other. With half of Wall Street looking on, the last thing either of them needed was to have word of their meeting get out. The two men eventually doubled back and found the room, but when Lewis arrived, Fuld was in the midst of a heated argument with a Fed staff member. It was only the second time the men had ever met, and the sharp tone of his hectoring startled Lewis. For about 20 minutes, Fuld explained how he pictured a deal might work, reiterating the proposal he had made to Curl a week earlier. Fuld said he'd want at least $25 a share. Lehman's shares had closed that day at $18.32. Lewis thought the number was far too high and couldn't see the strategic rationale. Unless he could buy the firm for next to nothing, the deal wasn't worth it to him. But he held his tongue. 2 days later, Lewis called Fuld back. "I don't think this is going to work for us," Lewis said as diplomatically as he could, while leaving open the possibility that they could discuss the matter again. Fuld was beside himself as he called Paulson at 12:35 p.m. to relay the bad news. Now all he was left with was the possibility of the Koreans, and he pressed Paulson to make a call to them on his behalf, a request that Paulson, having already interceded with Buffett and Bank of America, was now resisting. "I'm not going to pick up the phone and call the Koreans," Paulson told him. "If you want to scare someone, call them up and tell them I said they should buy Lehman Brothers," he said, explaining that his involvement would only heighten suspicion about the firm's prospects. "Dick, if they call me and want to ask questions, I'll do what I can to be constructive." It was just the latest bad piece of news of a very long day. That night, Bart McDade forwarded Fuld an email from a trader with more speculation about where the negative rumors were coming from. "It is clear that GS, Goldman Sachs, is driving the bus on the hedge fund's cabal and greatly influencing the downside momentum, LEH and others. Thought it was worth passing on." Fuld replied, "Should we be too surprised? Remember this, though. I will." Chapter 11. Robert Willemstad could feel the perspiration begin to soak through his undershirt as he strode along Pearl Street at 9:15 a.m. on Tuesday, July 29th, in Manhattan's financial district. Although the humidity was oppressive that summer morning, he was also anxious about his upcoming appointment with Tim Geithner at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Since accepting the position of CEO at AIG just over a month earlier, he had been working long hours to try to get a handle on the company's myriad problems. With the exception of a weekend trip to Vail over July 4th to visit his daughter, he had been at the office 7 days a week. When he began the job, he had announced plans to conduct a thorough strategic and operational review of AIG's businesses, and to complete the process in the next 60 to 90 days, and to hold an in-depth investor meeting shortly after Labor Day to lay it all out for you. As Willemstad started his investigation, his head of strategy, Brian T. Schreiber, pulled him aside and shared a startling discovery he had made. It could actually be a liquidity problem, not a capital problem. In other words, even though this massive insurance conglomerate had hundreds of billions of dollars worth of securities and collateral, given the credit crisis, it could find itself struggling to sell them fast enough or at high enough prices to meet its obligations. The situation even could become worse if one of the ratings agencies, like Moody's or Standard & Poor's, were to downgrade the firm's debt, which could trigger covenants in its debt agreements to post even more collateral. "You scared the shit out of me last night," Willemstad told Schreiber the following day, after spending the night contemplating the firm's liquidity issues. The problem would soon be further compounded, Willemstad realized, with the firm scheduled to report a $5.3 billion loss in its second quarter. On this muggy July day, Willemstad was on his way to see Geithner, whom he had only met for the first time a month earlier, to sound him out about getting some help if the markets turned against him. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York did not regulate AIG, or any insurance company for that matter, but Willemstad figured that between AIG's securities lending business and its financial products unit, Geithner might take an interest in his problems. Even more, he hoped that Geithner appreciated how closely AIG was interconnected with the rest of Wall Street, having written insurance policies worth hundreds of billions of dollars that the brokerage firms relied on as a hedge against other trades. Like it or not, their health depended on AIG's health. "No reason to panic, no reason to believe anything bad is going to happen," Willemstad said after Geithner had greeted him with his usual firm, athletic handshake and invited him back into his office. "But we've got this securities lending program." He explained that AIG lent out high-grade securities like treasuries in exchange for cash. Normally, it would have been a safe business, but because the company had invested that cash in subprime mortgages that had lost enormous value, no one could peg their exact price, which made them nearly impossible to sell. If AIG's counterparties, the firms on the other side of the trade, should all demand their cash back at the same time, Willemstad said, he could run into a serious problem. "You've made the Fed window available to the broker-dealers," he continued. "What's the likelihood, if AIG had a crisis, that we could come to the Fed for liquidity? We've got billions, hundreds of billions of dollars of securities, marketable collateral." "Well, we've never done that before," Geithner replied briskly, meaning that the Federal Reserve had never made a loan available to an insurance company, and he seemed none too swayed by Willemstad's argument. "I can appreciate that," Willemstad replied. "You never did it for brokers before either, but obviously there's some room here. After Bear Stearns' near-death experience, the Fed had decided to open the discount window to brokerage firms like Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch, and Lehman." "Yes," Geithner acknowledged, but said that it would require the approval of the entire Fed board, and, he added pointedly, "I would only recommend it if I thought I was making a good credit decision." He then delivered to Willemstad the same warning that he had given to Fuld the month before, when Fuld had sought bank holding company status for Lehman. "I think the problem is, it's going to exacerbate what you're trying to avoid," he said. "When it would get disclosed, that would cause concern among the counterparties. It would exacerbate anything we had." Willemstad could see he wasn't getting anywhere with his argument, as Geithner rose to indicate that he had to get to his next meeting, saying only, "Keep me informed." On July 29th, Lehman's Gulfstream circled over the airport in Anchorage, Alaska, preparing for its approach to land to refuel. Aboard was Dick Fuld, heading back from Hong Kong, where he and a small Lehman team had met with Min-Yu Sung of the Korea Development Bank. Fuld was in uncharacteristically good spirits that day, confident that he was finally getting closer to a deal. He had had a productive conversation with KDB, and both sides had agreed to continue talking. It would still be a long putt, he knew, but KDB had become his best hope. Min had indicated that he would be interested in buying a majority stake in Lehman. He knew Min was still anxious about Lehman's real estate portfolio, the toxic assets weighing it. But Min also seemed to be upbeat about the prospect of making KDB a major player on the world stage. There hadn't been much discussion about price at the meeting at the Grand Hyatt in downtown Hong Kong, but Fuld was confident that a deal might finally be at hand. Fuld was also pleased with himself for having kept the talks out of the press. He had been so concerned about leaks this time around that he had instructed the team he took with him to the meetings, Bart McDade, Skip McGee, Brad Whitman, Jesse Batal, and Kunho Cho, not to answer their phones. McGee had gone so far as to mislead his staff back in New York by leaving a voicemail for Mark Shafir, who had gone on the earlier trip to South Korea, telling him that he had flown to China to visit with clients. Fuld had organized the meeting in Hong Kong, as opposed to the more likely Seoul, partly so that if anyone was tracking the firm's plane, its destination would lead to less speculation. On the return trip, the Lehman team watched The Bank Job, a British heist movie, on the plane's large screen. Fuld had already seen it, and made the case for an action film instead. But McDade, who was increasingly taking control of the firm, won out. As they taxied to the refueling station, Fuld's good mood suddenly vanished. The maintenance crew had discovered an oil leak. As the pilot tried to coordinate a repair, the Lehman team ate lunch on the plane as it sat on the tarmac. But after an hour, it was uncertain whether that damage could be repaired. McDade started calling his secretary to see if they could book a commercial flight home. "When's the last time you flew commercial?" McDade ribbed Fuld, who was plainly not amused. On August 6, 2008, a team of bankers from Morgan Stanley arrived at the Treasury building and was escorted up to a conference room across from Paulson's office for what they all knew would be an unusual meeting. Looking for help with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, Paulson had called John Mack a week earlier to hire his firm as an advisor to the government. Paulson would have chosen Goldman were it not for the obvious public relations problem, or the fact that it was advising Fannie. He also briefly considered hiring Merrill Lynch, but Morgan Stanley seemed the best option. Mack had originally been reluctant even to take the assignment, for the cost of serving as Treasury's advisor on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac was that the firm could not conduct any business with the mortgage giants for the next 6 months, and therefore stood to lose out on tens of millions of dollars in fees. "How can we tell our shareholders we're walking away from this kind of money? I'm going to get asked about why I did that," he told his team. But after some soul-searching, Mack decided working for the government was the patriotic thing to do. Morgan Stanley would receive a token payment of $95,000, which would barely cover the cost of their secretary's overtime. Just a week earlier, the Senate had passed, and President Bush had signed into law, an act that gave Treasury the temporary authority to backstop Fannie and Freddie. Now, the question that faced Paulson was, what to do with that authority? He recognized that he had created an odd dilemma. Investors now assumed the government was planning to step in. That would make it even harder for Fannie and Freddie to raise capital on their own, as investors worried that a government intervention would mean they would get wiped out. Any sort of investment by the government increasingly seemed as if it could become a self-fulfilling prophecy. Either investors are going to be massively diluted, given the amount of equity they are going to need, or Freddie and Fannie are going to be nationalized, Dan Alpert, managing director of Westwood Capital LLC, had told Reuters that morning. Without a larger equity capital base, they are going to be incapable of surviving. In a Treasury conference room, Anthony Ryan, Assistant Secretary for Financial Markets, briefed the bankers on the department's work to date on the GSEs. Attending from Morgan Stanley were Robert Scully, 58, the firm's co-president, who had worked on the government's bailout of Chrysler nearly three decades earlier. Ruth Porat, 50, the head of its financial institutions banking group. And Daniel A. Sinkowitz, the 43-year-old vice chairman of Global Capital Markets. 10 minutes into Ryan's presentation, Paulson walked in, looking slightly distracted. "Everyone's going to scrutinize what we do," he told the group as he tried to inspire and scare them simultaneously. "I'm going to work you to the bone. But I'm confident of this. It will be the most meaningful assignment of your career." Scully pressed Paulson to explain his rationale for the assignment. "Just tell us what you're really looking to do here," he said. "Do you want to kick the can down the road?" "No," said Paulson, shaking his head. "I want to address the issue. I don't want to leave the problem unsolved." He was adamant that the project not become another bureaucratic exercise in producing PowerPoint presentations that would just get filed away. We have three objectives: market stability, mortgage availability, taxpayer protection. Scully was still skeptical, certain there had to be some political calculus involved. And with Freddie's reported loss of $821 million that morning, doing nothing no longer seemed a viable option. "Are there any policy options that are off the table, or, alternatively, are there any stakes you have in the ground in terms of starting points and approaches to this problem that you'd like us to think about?" Scully probed. "No, you have a clean sheet of paper," Paulson said. "All options are on the table. I'm willing to consider everything." A young child's squeal a few doors down suddenly halted the discussion. It was Paulson's granddaughter, Willa, who was visiting that day and waiting in a small conference room across from his office. Paulson was about to catch a flight with his family to attend the Olympic Games in Beijing. It was, however, a working vacation. He had a busy set of meetings with Chinese officials, and, as they all knew, he would be attached to his cell phone. He apologized to the group for cutting the meeting short. "I'll be back in 10 days," he told them. "I want a lot of progress." In the first week of August, Min Il-sung arrived in Manhattan from Seoul to continue talks with Lehman Brothers. The parties were still far from signing a final agreement, but they were inching closer to nailing down at least the outlines of one. On that Monday, McDade, who remained skeptical that a deal would come to pass, walked over to Sullivan and Cromwell's Midtown offices with his colleagues to begin formal negotiations. "They are never going to have the balls to do this," Mark Shafir said as he headed up Park Avenue with McDade and Skip McGee. Kunho Cho and Jesse Batal of Lehman, who were closest to Min, had flown over from Asia to help shepherd a deal. McGee had urged Full to stay at the office, despite his insistence on coming to the meeting. "Chill out," McGee had told him. "You are the CEO. You have to be the missing man." Wall Street parlance for the handy excuse they could use when they closed in on the final terms of the deal, but wanted to push for slightly better ones. They'd simply say they still needed approval from the CEO. McDade also had become increasingly anxious that Fuld's fragile state wouldn't help the negotiations. McDade was beginning to fear that Fuld suspected him of attempting to take over the firm. Often when he was in conversation with Gelband and Kirk, his proteges, Fuld would emerge seeming apprehensive, as if imagining they were plotting his ouster. Fuld's paranoia was only further encouraged when McDade refused to inhabit Joe Gregory's old office directly next to Fuld's, citing its bad karma. Instead, he took an office farther down the hall, where it was harder for Fuld to monitor him. In truth, McDade was increasingly in control of Lehman. He was in the process of putting together a document called the Game Plan, a detailed examination of the firm's finances and a vision for a way forward. It included a half dozen possible scenarios, most of which included some variation on dividing Lehman in two, a good bank that they'd keep and a bad bank that they'd spin off, thereby ridding themselves, at least on paper, of their worst real estate assets. The plan would enable Lehman to make a fresh start, unencumbered by assets that continued to fall in value. McDade also had pressed Fuld to put Neuberger Berman and the firm's investment management business up for sale, and an auction was already underway among a series of private equity firms. While the rumors about Lehman may have continued unabated, the leaks coming out of the company appeared to be shrinking in volume. A few weeks after McDade was appointed president, McGee gave him a T-shirt with the inscription, "A Person Familiar with the Situation," a wry reference to how the financial press generically referred to its sources. McGee had told him, "Give it to Scott," a not-so-subtle dig at Scott Friedheim, who managed much of the firm's media strategy. The first meeting that morning at Sullivan and Cromwell was to allow the Koreans an opportunity to review Lehman's commercial real estate assets. Mark Walsh, the architect of the firm's foray into the commercial real estate market, gave a presentation to the group. But Min quickly found Walsh unprepared and pulled aside Kunho to tell him as much. "I need to understand this better," he told him in Korean. "I feel very uncomfortable with the valuations." It quickly became clear that Min wanted nothing to do with Lehman's commercial real estate holdings. For at least an hour, it looked like the talks could collapse. But that afternoon, the two sides started working on a new structure. Min said he was interested in buying a majority stake in Lehman, but only if it were to spin off its commercial and residential real estate assets into a separate company, so that KDB's investment couldn't be impacted. The discussions seemed to be going well, except for the fact that Fuld kept calling McDade's and McGee's cell phones every 20 minutes to ask for an update. By the next morning, at 11 o'clock, Min said he had received authorization for Korean regulators to make an initial offer. He said he was prepared to pay 1.25 times Lehman's book value, or the value at which Lehman held its assets on its balance sheet. The deal, which was still subject to a discussion about the firm's true book value and would have included Lehman spinning off the real estate business, meant that KDB was valuing Lehman somewhere between $20 and $25 a share, a premium over its current share price, which had closed the day before at $15.57. Whether Min was posturing, as some of the Lehman bankers suspected, remained an open question, but McDade, McGee, and the rest of the Lehman team said they were inclined to accept his offer. However, McDade said he wanted to retreat back to the firm's headquarters to discuss it with Fuld first. They agreed that both sides would return at 7 p.m. in hopes of reaching at least an agreement in principle. When both sides reconvened several hours later, a surprise guest arrived, Fuld. The goal for the Lehman team was to press Min to sign a letter of intent ahead of the final agreement, even if it meant it would take several more weeks to hammer out the details. That gesture, everyone agreed, would take some pressure off Lehman's stock. Fuld took a seat alongside McDade, McGee, and Kunho, an inexplicable scowl on his face. Across from them at the table were Min and his banker, Gary Baranczyk of Perella Weinberg Partners. "Look, we hear you. We understand what you want to do," McDade said, referring to Min's plan to acquire a controlling stake in Lehman after it spun off the real estate assets. "Let's start," Fuld interjected. "I think you're making a big mistake," he told Min. "You're going to miss a great opportunity. There's a lot of value in these real estate assets. Pressing Min to buy at least some of them." As the conversation continued, Fuld suggested that Min's plan to pay 1.25 times book value was too low, instead recommending they negotiate on the basis of 1.5 times book value. McDade and McGee couldn't believe what they were witnessing. They had spent the past 2 days orchestrating a deal based on spinning off the real estate assets, and now Fuld was trying to retrade on their work. Worse, a look of horror crossed Min's face. Min pulled Baranczyk aside and whispered, "I'm not comfortable with this." And in response, Baranczyk spoke up on behalf of KDB. He said they would only negotiate on the basis of 1.25 times book valuation. And then, as his aggravation mounted, started questioning Lehman's accounting. "I don't believe that you've taken all the write-downs," he said, reiterating why they weren't interested in the real estate assets. "Okay," Fuld said, his frustration showing. What do you think our real estate portfolio should be marked at? Before Baranczyk could answer, McDade piped up. Well, we have a term sheet, he interjected, trying to steer the conversation back in a more productive direction. Why don't we look at that? Look, I just think we need to take a break, Baranczyk said, sensing the tension could topple the talks. As they stepped into the hallway, Fuld, having misread Min's mood, approached him and again started promoting the idea of selling him the real estate. McGee, who was standing behind Min and could see this conversation was only antagonizing him, tried to signal Fuld, slicing his finger across his throat to urge him to stop badgering the Korean. Finally managing to break free of Fuld, Min took Baranczyk to a small room to study the term sheet, which was more a list of broad principles than a formal agreement. As they reviewed it, Min nodded at each bullet point until he reached the final one, which stipulated that KDB would provide credit to Lehman to help support it. To Min, that was an instant red flag. Was Lehman seeking an open-ended credit line, hoping to leverage KDB's balance sheet to bolster its own standing? Min, looking pained, grabbed Kunho Cho, his friend when they worked at Lehman together, and asked to talk to him privately. Even before Min spoke a word, Cho could tell it wasn't going to be good. There is a serious credibility problem here, he said in Korean. All of this time we have negotiated in good faith, consistently, and we were moving toward the goal we all wanted, and now, all of a sudden, it's a new picture. Clearly frustrated, Min continued. Look, it's not about 1.25 versus 1.5 times book, or a $2 billion versus a $4 billion credit line. It's none of that. It's the way you conducted the meeting. I just feel uncomfortable about the way this whole thing has been conducted by Lehman senior management. I cannot continue on this basis. Cho, who had helped persuade Min to fly to New York for the meeting, was devastated. When Min returned to the main conference room, he looked apologetically at Fuld, and then at the rest of the bankers assembled around the table. I'd like to thank you all, but I don't think we have a structure that works, he said, and got up to leave. Gary Baranczyk can continue the dialogue. A dolorous look came over Fuld's face. So, you mean that's it? He asked, raising his voice. You're just going back to Korea? Steve Shaffron was at a gas station in Sun Valley, Idaho, one brisk morning in August, when Hank Paulson called. Shaffron, one of Paulson's special advisors at Treasury, was on vacation. Give me an update on Lehman, Paulson instructed. Shaffron, who turned off the engine of his 15-year-old Land Rover, recognizing that this might take some time, had been assigned by Paulson earlier in the summer to a special project, to act as a coordinator between the SEC and the Federal Reserve to begin contingency planning for a Lehman Brothers bankruptcy. The original assignment had actually been to ascertain systemic risk in the banking system and to make sure the various government agencies were talking to one another, but it had soon morphed into focusing almost exclusively on Lehman. It was by its very nature a secret undertaking, given that he wasn't allowed to let anyone, least of all Lehman Brothers, know that the government was even thinking about the possibility, no matter how improbable it might be. If the stock market caught even a whiff of it, Lehman's shares would plunge. But Paulson, who had been speaking to Fuld almost every day, had become convinced that Lehman was going to face a struggle in its attempts to raise capital, and they needed to prepare for the very worst. Indeed, Paulson had become so frustrated with Fuld's various plans that he had assigned Ken Wilson to be Fuld's personal liaison. I'm going to tell Dick that he's talking to you, Paulson told Wilson. It's just a waste of time. I'll talk with him when he's got something really important to say to me. For Shaffron, dealing with other government agencies was something of a novelty. He had moved himself and his children to Washington only a year earlier, after his wife of 24 years, Janet, was killed in a plane accident. They had been living in Sun Valley, where he had gone after retiring from Goldman Sachs. Shaffron had worked at the firm for 15 years, serving as Paulson's point person in Hong Kong, helping him in his efforts to gain entree to China. He had come to Washington to start over. For Shaffron, The Lehman Project was even more awkward than it would be for other Treasury staffers, because he was a casual friend of Fuld's. They knew each other from Sun Valley, where Shafran had become a city councilman in Ketchum, and Fuld owned 97 acres in the area, worth some $27 million, with a main home on a private road across the Bigwood River and a cabin on the shore of Pettit Lake, right near Shafran's. They played golf together at the Valley Club and socialized occasionally. Shafran liked Fuld and admired his intensity. But now, as Shafran was sitting in the gas station parking lot on the phone, he gave Paulson a progress report. He said he had held some conference calls with the Fed and SEC, and while they thought it was impossible to truly estimate the systemic risk, he felt that they were finally at least paying attention to the challenge. "They are on it," he said. "I'm comfortable." He explained that they had identified four risks within Lehman: its repo book, or portfolio of repurchase agreements, its derivative book, its broker-dealer, and its illiquid assets, such as real estate and private equity investment. Paulson knew he couldn't do much for Lehman himself. Treasury itself did not have any powers to regulate Lehman, so it would be left to the other agencies to help manage a failure. But that made him anxious. Earlier in the summer, David Nason had held a meeting with the SEC and told Paulson they were not on top of the situation. With streams of spreadsheets of Lehman's derivative positions splayed out before them, in the Grant conference room, he had questioned Michael A. Macchiaroli, an associate director at the SEC, about what they would do if Lehman failed. "There are a lot of positions," Macchiaroli said. "I'm not sure what we'd do with the positions, but we'd try to net them out, and we'd go in there, and SIPC would come in," he added, referring to Securities Investor Protection Corporation, which acts in a quasi-FDIC capacity, but on a much smaller scale. "That can't be the answer," Nason replied. "That would be a mess." "The problem is that half their book is the UK," Macchiaroli said, explaining that many of Lehman's trades went through its unit in London. "And their counterparties are outside the United States, and we don't have jurisdiction over them." In the event of a disaster, all the SEC could do was try to maintain Lehman's U.S. broker-dealer unit, but the holding company and all of its international subsidiaries would have to file for bankruptcy. There were no good answers. Nason had raised the possibility that they might have no choice in an emergency but to go to Congress and seek permission to guarantee all of Lehman's trades. But as quickly as he raised the idea, he shot himself down. "To guarantee all the obligations of the holding company, we would have to ask Congress to use taxpayer money to guarantee obligations that are outside the U.S., he announced to the room. "How the hell would we ask for that?" Across a sweeping meadow from the Jackson Lake Lodge, the towering white peaks of the Tetons offered a majestic view, but one that no longer took Ben Bernanke's breath away the way it once had. As he walked its trails on August 22nd, he recalled that it was here, at the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City's Summer Symposium in the Grand Teton National Park, that he had first made his name nearly a decade ago. For the next 3 days, however, he could expect little more than criticism, questioning of his actions over the past year, and questions about what role the government should play with respect to Fannie and Freddie. In the summer of 1999, when the mania for internet stocks was in full bloom, Bernanke and Mark Gertler, an economist at New York University, had presented a paper at Jackson Hole that contended that bubbles of that sort need not be a huge concern of the central bank. Pointing to steps taken by the Federal Reserve in the 1920s, to Papa's stocks bubble that only created problems when an economic downturn took hold, Bernanke and Gertler argued that the central bank should restrict itself to its primary responsibility, trying to keep inflation stabilized. Rising asset prices should only be a concern for the Fed when they fed inflation. A bubble, once pricked, can easily degenerate into a panic, they argued in a presentation that had been the talk of the conference and had attracted the favorable notice of Alan Greenspan. A year ago, Jackson Hole had been a more trying experience for Bernanke. As the credit crisis escalated that summer, Bernanke and a core group of advisors, Geithner, Warsh, Donald Cohn, the Fed vice chairman, Bill Dudley, the New York Fed's markets desk chief, and Brian Madigan, director of the Division of Monetary Affairs, huddled inside the Jackson Lake Lodge, trying to figure out how the Fed should respond to the credit crisis. The group roughed out a two-pronged approach that some would later call the Bernanke Doctrine. The first part involved using the best-known weapon in the Fed's arsenal, cutting interest rates. To address the crisis of confidence in the markets, the policymakers wanted to offer support, but not at the expense of encouraging recklessness in the future. In his address at the 2007 conference, Bernanke had said, "It is not the responsibility of the Federal Reserve, nor would it be appropriate, to protect lenders and investors from the consequences of their financial decisions." Yet his very next sentence, "But developments in financial markets can have broad economic effects felt by many outside the markets, and the Federal Reserve must take those effects into account when determining policy," bolstered what had been perceived as the central bank's policy since the hasty Fed-organized Wall Street-financed bailout of the hedge fund Long-Term Capital Management in 1998. If those consequences were serious enough to impact the entire financial system, the Fed might indeed have broader obligations that might require intervention. It was precisely this view that influenced his thinking in protecting Bear Stearns. By this year's conference, the Bernanke Doctrine had come under attack. As Bernanke, looking exhausted, sat slumped at a long table in the lodge's wood-paneled conference room, speaker after speaker stood up to criticize the Fed's approach to the financial crisis as essentially ad hoc and ineffective, and as promoting moral hazard. Only Alan Blinder, once a Fed vice chairman and a former Princeton colleague of Bernanke's, defended the Fed. Blinder told this tale. One day, a little Dutch boy was walking home when he noticed a small leak in the dike that protected the people in the surrounding town. He started to stick his finger in the hole, but then he remembered the moral hazard lesson he had learned in school. "The companies that built this dike did a terrible job," the boy said. "They don't deserve a bailout, and doing so would just encourage more shoddy construction. Besides, the foolish people who live here should never have built their homes on a floodplain." So, the boy continued on his way home. Before he arrived, the dike burst, and everyone for miles around drowned, including the little Dutch boy. Perhaps you've heard the Fed's alternative version of this story. In this kinder, gentler version, the little Dutch boy, somewhat desperate and worried about the horrors of the flood, stuck his finger in the dike and held it there until help arrived. It was painful and not guaranteed to work, and the little boy would rather have been doing other things. But he did it anyway, and all the people who lived behind the dike were saved from the error of their ways. The previous day, Bernanke, in his address to the symposium, had made a plea to move beyond a finger-in-the-dike strategy by urging Congress to create a statutory resolution regime for non-banks. "A stronger infrastructure would help to reduce systemic risk," Bernanke noted. "It would also mitigate moral hazard and the problem of too big to fail by reducing the range of circumstances in which systemic stability concerns might be expected by markets to prompt government intervention. A statutory resolution regime for non-banks, besides reducing uncertainty, would also limit moral hazard by allowing the government to resolve failing firms in a way that is orderly, but also wipes out equity holders and haircuts some creditors, analogous to what happens when a commercial bank fails." Bernanke did not mention Fannie or Freddie, but their fate was on the minds of many at Jackson Hole. That Friday, Moody's cut its ratings on the preferred shares of both companies to just below the level of non-investment grade, or junk. Expectations increased that Treasury would have to pull the trigger and put capital in Fannie and Freddie. Jackson Hole also had, of course, long been a popular destination for the very wealthy. James Wolfenson, the former Schroders and Solomon Brothers banker who became president of the World Bank, was one of Jackson Hole's celebrity residents, and during the 2008 symposium, he held a dinner at his home. In addition to Bernanke, the guest list included two former Treasury officials, Larry Summers and Roger Altman, as well as Austin Goolsbee, an economic advisor to Barack Obama, who was about to be officially nominated as the Democratic candidate for president. That night, Wolfenson posed two questions to his guests. Would the credit crisis be a chapter or a footnote in the history books? As he went around the table and surveyed opinions, everyone agreed that it would probably be a footnote. Then, Wolfenson asked, "Is it more likely that we'll have another Great Depression, or will it be more of a lost decade?"